No, I don't think so.
All right. Okay. All right. First question. Last week, Sean and Tim talked about not changing the tool to fit your story, as was done in the submission example they shared. I have a follow-up question about the foolscap with one middle build versus the foolscap with two middle builds. If a story is working with the original foolscap, is it necessary to break the middle build into two? Or will there be some stories with one middle build and some with two?
Well, here's a situation where I'm learning as I go, and the more I learn, the higher the resolution I can bring to the toolbox. So the answer to the question is, if the foolscap works without going into the details of the second metal build, is that okay? And the answer is, of course, everything is okay. Everything is okay as long as the story works. So I've edited over 300 novels in my career, and I didn't pull out the second middle build until recently. And I only did that in response to the difficulties that the community was having with that middle build, which is massive. It's 50% of the story. So what's awesome is that when I broke the middle build, it coincided and is complementary with my goal of mapping Story Grid fundamental tool stuff onto cognitive science. So I'm trying to take what people consider extraordinarily subjective and are reluctant to even consider that there's any empirical stuff within it. I'm trying to map that onto an empirical framework based upon scientific research and empirical rigor. So that's what resulted was, okay, so I had this interest from the community saying, hey, we're having a hard time with this 50% middle build. If you could provide some more guidance about how to construct that, that would be great. All right, so that's one section of my brain. And the other section of my brain was, hey man, I'd really like to make sure that this stuff is completely coherent and can map onto cognitive science. All right, so what happened was, I thought to myself, well, maybe there's a way of bringing both of these things together. And the third quality was, I've been getting a lot of interest from the community about updating and sort of putting the Story Grid sensibility on top of the hero's journey. Because the hero's journey is, I think for good reason, being picked at and examined through the lens of contemporary society and the evolution of our cognitive framing about the way our society works. What I mean by that is that's a very abstract way of saying people don't like all the shit about colonialization of people going and, you know, sort of taking shit from another culture and coming back to their culture and giving that gift to the good people as opposed to those people that we take it from. And we don't like the concept of the goddess because the goddess brings in all this crap about gender. And so I heard that and I'm like, you know what? That's really true. What if we could sort of swipe that stuff away and clean up this culturally locked in hero's journey from, I mean, let's face it, Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, these are guys from the early part of the 20th century. They believed in a cultural framework that we don't live in any longer, thank God. And so wouldn't it be good to be able to, hey, say, hey, that stuff is amazing. Can we work with it, reframe it so that it can be more helpful to people who don't want to think about, for lack of a better phrase, cultural appropriation. I think that's the word, where somebody goes and takes something from a culture. And anyway, so we've got these three things that I'm trying to balance here. The demand from the community about upgrading the middle build so that it's easier to conceptually create. Two, what's going on with this hero's journey? It seems kind of archaic and ridiculous. Isn't there a way to make it more interesting and more applicable to today's culture? That's two. And the third one is my own personal interest in cognitive science. And cognitive science is simply like, how is it that we actually work? You know, how do our brains and our bodies navigate this place we call Earth? Like, how does that work? You know, all the way from the firing of a neuron to the eating of an ice cream cone. There's a whole series of steps in between that process. Okay. So let me just funnel it back to the question. The question was, is it okay if the middle, if the story works just with one middle build as opposed to two? Answer is always yes. If the story works, please, unless you really want to pick it apart, let it go. If it's working, great. But if you want to say like, hey, man, I wonder if this is mapping onto this story good framework, wouldn't it be interesting to think about that? Then, yeah, now apply these new tools and see if you can learn something and tighten up some nuts and bolts in your story that can make it a little bit stronger. So what the when I broke the middle build into two, it corresponded with my thinking about the heroic journey in terms of insight. So there's all this really cool empirical research in psychology and cognitive science that has explored the notion of how do we have insights? How does that happen? What's the light bulb moment? How does that actually happen? If we know how it happens, maybe we can induce more insights. So it'd be cool to be able to investigate the process of having an insight. Like when you're in the shower and you're like, oh my gosh, I should do that, right? We all had these moments. And so they're trying to empirically, you know, break it apart so that we can figure out, well, if we know the steps of insight and the proper conditions that will allow us to have more insights, that would be good information to have, because the more insights we have, the better we can navigate the world. Cool. So the process of insight is really, really interesting. And it has a lot to do with the concept of the macro point of view and the micro point of view. It's called the transparency to opacity shift. So, for example, what that means is right now I'm looking through my glasses. So they're actually transparent to me because I'm taking a macro view of the world. Now, I can put an opacity shift on it, take off my glasses, and now focus on the micro of my glasses, right? So I'm actually looking at the framing of my world with my own micro point of view. So this is a really great metaphor for story, right? So when we're experiencing a story, we've got transparency through the micro, and we're looking at the macro, And that macro hits our perceptive programming in our brain and enables us to have very deep emotional responses. So that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about genre, right? So when we talk about a horror story, people want to go to a horror story to experience the thrill of terror and fear. So that's the macro emotional response that they're looking for from a horror story. Cool. So let's put on our horror glasses and go to the horror movie and we can experience the fear. Now, if we're the creator, we want to pull off the glasses and see how that actually happens. We want the micro point of view of how that happens. So all of this taking off the glasses and putting on the glasses, guess what this is? This is called breaking frame. So our cognitive framing is the way we're looking at the world. So here's what's really cool, is that when we get stumped and we're looking through our glasses at the macro world, we can't figure shit out. The way we can start having insights is to go, oh, I can't figure this out. I got my glasses on and everything just seems like impossible to figure out. Cool. So what should I do? Well, you got to break frame. So what you do is you pull your glasses off and you look at the micro detail of the input that would be hitting your glasses. In our world, this is looking at a scene, right? We pull off our glasses and we go through our spreadsheet and we look scene by scene by scene and see, oh shit, this scene's working, this one isn't, they're not tying together, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so insight is about breaking frame. Cool. Now, I just described looking at the structural stuff of story. Now, if we look at the thematic movement, the abstract worldview shift of a character in a story, then we can start to pull out interesting things. Because the process by which we are able to have insight requires a movement through an emotional landscape. So I talk about four quadrants, and I wrote a book with a neurosurgeon called Cognitive Dominance, which really breaks down these four quadrants into very clear, quarters. So the upper right-hand quarter is sort of positive-positive. It's like a Descartes, it's like a target. So you've got an XY axis, and then you've got an X axis that goes horizontally, and you have a Y axis that goes vertically. And so it breaks it into four quarters. Now the upper right-hand corner is a positive vertical and a positive horizontal. That's what I call the flow state, when shit's working really well for us. So what happens in a story is that we sort of hit a person who lives in a sort of flow state, meaning they've got their glasses on, and their glasses have been working for them for a long time. It's what I call their code 1.0. So they've got these glasses, their code 1.0, and this is the beginning of the story. And something happens unexpected. Something drops into that quadrant that is unexpected. And it pushes them downward into the lower right-hand quadrant. Now, the lower right-hand quadrant is what I call the calm before the storm quadrant. This is sort of like when you got into college or you got into a good trade school or you got a new job or something good happened. So it's good on the x-axis, but you get a feeling within yourself. And it's kind of like, oh shit, what if they don't like me? What if this new opportunity turns out to be the worst thing that ever happens to me? So it's this sort of like inner guarding kind of weirdness. And you know you should be happy, but you feel really weird. Okay, you got to pay attention to that. Because that's the calm before the storm quadrant, and it's your body, which is a really incredible detector And we often turn off our body signals in favor of our brain. But you got to listen to the body. So when you're feeling that, it's kind of like, oh, shit, I'm in the calm before the storm quadrant. Okay, so what do I do here? And there's a whole series of actions that you do to sort of try and get back up into that flow state. Nobody wants to break their frame. Nobody wants to break code 1.0. Because code 1.0 got us where we are right now. Like, I don't want to completely reinvent StoryGrid because, shit, it got me where I am right now. But you got to keep thinking about this stuff. Okay, so that's the lower right-hand quadrant. Now what happens is, guess what happens in a story? You can't get back. You try everything. You try every tactic you possibly can for your code 1.0, and you burn out all of your skill set, and still you have not metabolized that unexpected event that dropped into your life. And this is what happens now, and this is about the midpoint shift of a story. The character transitions and falls. It's literally a fall. And you fall into the deep, dark abyss of the lower left-hand quadrant. The lower left-hand quadrant is all is lost. All the shit that you believe to be true is now completely evaporated. And you're swimming in chaos. You can't figure anything out. And this is really a requirement. It's a painful, painful truth. But this is required in order to level up your growth and your cognitive framing. You've got to fall into chaos. And the thing is, nobody wants to fall into chaos. This is why it's called the hero's journey, not the average person's trip to the drugstore journey. It's called the hero. The hero willingly accepts that they are going to fall into chaos and their worldview is going to be obliterated. And that obliteration is extraordinarily destabilizing. It's emotionally painful. It hurts. It's a sacrifice. It sucks because everything feels terrible. That's the lower left-hand quadrant. And this is the third part of your story. This is when Jessie and Tim's story, she doesn't know what to do anymore. Her brother tells her that she has to go and kill the president. It doesn't make any sense to her. She thought her brother was a good person, and now she's discovered he's not what she thought he was. She doesn't know what's going on. And meanwhile, she's got to go fight in this threshing thing, and it's a mess, and she doesn't know what to do. So in this third quadrant is the all is lost moment. And guess what happens is, and this is also, you know, tracks with the Kubler-Ross change curve, right? So in this place, we hit pit, we hit the bottom. And the only way to get out of chaos is to grab hold of something. And that grabbing hold of something thematically in a story is when the character realizes, I'm gonna die. I might not die today, but eventually I'm going to die. Now, death is the only certainty that any of us can count on. And nobody wants to deal with it because it sucks. We don't know what happens after we die. We've got a lot of great theories, but we have no idea what happens when we die. So this bottom, this all is lost quadrant, is thematically about the protagonist coming to the conclusion that they don't have any certainty about anything but death. Now, this even works for all kinds of stories. I'm talking abstract themes here. So in an action story, it's literally death, right? But, you know, for some of your internal ones, it's more about the death of a relationship or blah. Although I think at its core, the writer knows this is the moment the character confronts death. And this is like the subject of so much philosophy of you know, in history. It's the big question. What do we do when we know we're going to die? Okay. So in that All Is Lost quadrant, your protagonist finally hits the pit and they come to the realization, shit, I'm going to die. Therefore, what am I going to do on Earth until I die such that it provides something meaningful to me? How can I create some meaning to my life in this moment? And that is the moment, that's what we have to think about when we're in chaos. Do I want to die panicking and stealing the last raft from the Titanic? Or do I want to die helping people who are younger than I am survive? Right? That's thematically what your character's dealing with here. And then once that character comes to the realization, I'm going to die. I've got to create meaning. I'm going to stick to this meaningful creation part. I'm going to sacrifice something of myself so that those people who I leave behind might have a better go of it on Earth. Right? That is the meaningful journey of the hero. They come to say to themselves, shit, if I die, at least I'm going to die for a purpose. At least I'm going to die with meaning. Okay. So that's the third quadrant. And then that, once they make that choice, then guess what happens? They completely open up their cognitive capability. And now, they don't look at goal states in quite the same way that they did before. So the goal state of getting a brand new boat starts to, that's meaningless, man. So all these goal states, these wants that the character was so invested in at the beginning of the story become meaningless to them. And once they lose that frame, guess what happens? They attune to reality in a way that they never could before. And so they attune themselves and they start to actually authentically react to reality as it unfolds in the moment, as opposed to, shit, I wish this person would stop talking so I can say what I want to say, right? We all have that experience where we're in a conversation, we're like, yeah, let me say my thing, right? So we're not actually in the moment having an authentic conversation. We're actually just waiting for our turn to talk. That's a good metaphor for the way the hero starts out in the world. They've got this code 1.0, it's gonna work for them. As long as they keep, you know, keep going through the motions of the code, they keep running the code, everything's going to be fine for them. And what they discover is that's not true. So in the ending payoff, which is the upper left-hand quadrant of our Descartesian sort of schema, that's called the birth of a new skill. That's the birth of the new skill. And it's positive internally, but it's negative externally. So it hurts externally to build a new skill, but it's actually very good for us internally as we build that new skill. And so this is the opening up of the cognitive framing of the hero so that they can learn something new. And the way they learn something new is through participatory knowledge. So they and their compatriots work together in a way that enables them to to build a new skill. So Jessie, at the end of Tim's novel, has a new skill. Her new skill is to be able to see the world with a much, much more mature point of view. She can see that people can be good and bad at the same time, that her brother can have some very good qualities, and he can also be extraordinarily monomaniacal. So, just to get back to the original question, that middle build is the second and third quadrant in my four quadrant system. And you can look at the story. Obviously, the critical part is to get your hero to All Is Lost. But there are some techniques that I can recommend for that first part of the middle build, which is about sort of burning out your procedural knowledge. The character's procedural knowledge, they just, like in Tim's novel, Jesse burns out her procedural knowledge in that first severing, right? She's so freaking smart, she breaks the game. But that's like her big trick, right? Once she blows that, she's kind of like, oh shit, I don't know what to do from here. And then that second severing is when she has that psychological break where she tumbles into chaos right in the middle. So to answer the question again, it's totally cool if you just use the three-act structure and you don't get into this minutia of the middle build one and middle build two. Totally cool. However, if you feel like your book works, hey, test it. See if that middle build one and middle build two can actually make it a little bit better. Now, you know, we all have to move on with our lives. And, you know, if you have a story that's working and it's ready to ship and you can get it in the marketplace and people will like it, you know, maybe you should let that puppy go and think about middle build one and middle build two for your next project. All right. Sorry for the long answer, but I think that kind of gives you the state of the story grid stuff now.
All right. That was only 28 minute answer. It's fine. this one's from Alyssa. Can you talk a bit more about the essential tactic of the characters and what you mean by this? What questions do you ask yourself when you're trying to figure out the answer to this question?
Okay, sure. Okay, the essential tactic, we sort of refreshed the language because the higher resolution that we get, the more we have to be very, very specific about the language that we use. So we used to call it the essential action, and we decided to call it the essential tactic for this reason. Remember, I'm proposing that the on-the-ground movement from scene to scene follows the action sort of genre abstract movement, okay? So in a particular scene, and all of this comes from my acting training from years ago. And in acting, what the actor's job is to actually figure out what to do moment by moment, or to have some options in your brain when you're actually performing a scene with another character. The job is to have a whole series of active tactics in your mind and have a grand strategy for the scene. So just to remind everybody, strategy is the grand strategy of a war is we're going to begin on this day and we're going to end on this day, and these are all the tactics we're going to use in order to win this war, and we're going to get out on that day. That's a grand arcing strategy. Tactics are the moment-by-moment choices that the generals use during a battle or, you know, a series of conflicts. And what's a story about a series of conflicts? So we chose what's the essential tactic. All right, so what's a tactic? A tactic for an actor is if I want something by the end of this scene, that's why you have a scene, is one character wants something, the other character wants something else. There's a battle, there's conflict, somebody wins what they want, someone doesn't win what they want, or any variety of that, okay? So what a tactic is as an actor, you might say, oh, I'm gonna use this language that the writer gave me, but my intention is to get someone on my side. So how do I get someone on my side? Well, I flatter them. Hey, that's a really nice shirt you have on today, Tim. I'm wondering if you might come over and mow my lawn for me, right? So the flatter, I know it's terrible, but the flattering is a tactic. And if the flattering doesn't work, I have to shift tactics, right? Then maybe I'll get, oh, Tim, remember three years ago, I came over and mowed your lawn? So to guilt someone would be a tactic, right? So the essential tactic in the scene is exactly like that. It's about determining what is the essential moment, the tactical choice of the scene that critically shifts the value at stake. So yeah, I think that's the answer to the question.
All right. Is the phone call a scene in itself or part of another scene? I have quite a few phone calls presently in my work, but they tend to be part of a larger scene. Thelma and Louise seem to have scenes that feed directly into the phone booth scene instead of solid cuts between that and another. So the question is the phone call a scene in itself or part of another scene?
It can be either. The way they use the phone call scene type in Thelma Louise was to contrast the two characters, right? So Thelma, I forget who is who. The Susan Sarandon character doesn't take any shit. And so, you know, she makes a phone call. She's in control of that phone call. That guy's her bitch. And he's like, oh, hi. Oh, my God. I can't believe it's you, right? So she's controlling. And he's like, by the way, I love you. And she's like, oh, that's nice. Anyway, when's the money coming, right? Cool. Then she's like, she goes and she sees Gina Davis. She goes, you got to go call your husband and tell him whatever the hell you're going to tell him. But you got to take care of this. So then we see the way Gina Davis handles the phone call, which is her coming into herself. She changes in that scene. So the Susan Sarandon character, there's absolutely a shift in the scene and there's conflict and there's all that great stuff, but she doesn't really have this big character arcing shift like the Gina Davis character does. Gina Davis comes into herself and is like, fuck this. I am, you know, you can't talk to me like that. Bye. So the way you use the phone call is you gotta look at your phone call scenes and say, what the hell is the point of this thing? And the second thing you have to do is say, how can I get this down to the minimum viable amount of exchanges? Because the phone call or the text or the email exchange is not an exciting experience for the reader. So you've got to make it really good. So you got to have it drop in a lot of conflict, all that kind of stuff. Whether or not it's its own scene is really a stylistic choice by the creator. Yes, they can be beats within a larger framework. Like I could be in the middle of doing something. I could get a phone call. I could do the phone call very quickly, slam down the phone, and then continue with my scene. The phone call, there's a great example of this in a play called The Sunshine Boys. I can't believe I remember this, but... The Sunshine Boys was this, I think it was Neil Simon. Anyway, there's these two guys who are old performers and they're gonna get the act back together, but they really hate each other at this point and they're just battling. And as they're sort of trying to figure out whether or not to get the act on the road, they get a phone call. And so the guy, so it's a really nice scene. It shows you how a phone call can be an unexpected event in a scene that up levels the conflict. So yeah, there's no clear answer about how you're going to use a phone call scene other than keep it to its minimum viable word count. Don't have a 20-page phone call. Use them sparingly and use them as the means to reveal character as opposed to doing revelation stuff. So revelation in phone call is really not good, I don't think. So revelation, when I say, oh my gosh, the house is on fire, you know, like that just doesn't work. But if it's character development in a phone call, the way the character handles the phone call at the beginning versus the end, then they can work. But, and the Thelma and Louise is a good example of how to use them.
All right. So I'm going to jump to this one because it's more about the chaos stuff. From Megan, in many love stories, the lovers enter a new world together after a midpoint moment of intimacy. For example, in Twilight, Edward takes Bella to his home for the first time. She's in the vampire world. Then everything falls apart down the road. The question, is this new world together chaotic because it is a new place with new rules, even though it is a happy, wonder-filled experience for the couple?
Well, I would have to analyze specifically, but generally I think that the midpoint moment of intimacy, which happens a lot in a love story, is immediately followed by a breakup or a chaotic fall for a very good reason. And that's because the characters, they come to realize that their worldview isn't going to work in this new world. So it's like when the poor boy goes to the ball, he's out of his element, and he finds the upper class woman or man or whatever, and they might have this moment of connection, but the vulnerability after that hits us like a freight train. Oh my gosh, I'll have to leave. What's my father going to think of this person? What's blah? So that's why after that sort of first kiss or first intimate connection, the characters usually tumble into all is lost. Because in order to form a deep relationship with another human being, you got to jettison a lot of shit. And you're used to that stuff and you like that stuff. And, you know, I used to watch 9 hours of football every Sunday and Saturday, and I can't do that anymore. So there's an all is lost quality to forming a relationship that, that is really a nice, you know, mile marker in a love story. Because you can externalize these things in ways that will really get to the heart of what's so difficult about, you know, being vulnerable and forming a union with another human being. It's a heroic thing. You got to be a hero to be in a relationship. You got to sacrifice.
All right. In the action book, you lay out the obligatory scenes. Do all of the obligatory scenes have to be satisfied in the external action journey, Or can some of them be satisfied with the internal worldview journey? For example, in a story where the protagonist doesn't refuse the call for the external action story, can I satisfy the refusal of the call by having the protagonist refuse the internal change by sticking with their code 1.0 behavior?
Yeah. What I've discovered is that these obligatory scenes in the action story have an even more abstract projection in the worldview. So if we look at story as sort of a cell, the central nucleus planet of a story is the movement around this Earth-like nucleus for the character. And the outer cellular wall is the worldview cognitive opening. So worldview is another word for cognitive opening or cognitive, contraction. So a story is a process by which we take a character and they either open up their cognitive framing and grow as a human being by the end of the story. So they've leveled up their humanity by the end, or they've degraded and they've become lesser. So they've spiraled downward as opposed to spiraling upward. So the obligatory scenes that are outlined in the action story beat are directed toward literal external action as much as I can recall in my mind right now. Now, I'm working on the worldview beat, and the worldview beat would be much more about holding on to code 1.0. So my advice is to use these obligatory scenes as guidance systems. So there's, for example, the moment talking about the love story, right? So there's a moment of intimacy generally in a love story around midpoint. So you might, if you're doing a performance story, you might have a subplot of love story and use that trope from love story as a means to externalize an internal reluctance to leave code 1.0. So perhaps the protagonist is attracted to someone, they have an opportunity to have an intimate moment with them, and they go, oh, I gotta go. And so they shut down their ability to try and open up that frame by rejecting an intimate moment with another human being. And that's a means by which you can play with all those sort of liminal genre ideas that go up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So if let's just for fun say Maslow's hierarchy of needs is like a ladder. And your character is trying to climb up that ladder as they're revolving around this action nucleus. So there's any number of rungs that you can play with in your story that can help, make your story more innovative and original and interesting. So generally, from the question, I can tell that you are engaging with the abstract ideas that are presented in that beat in a way that are going to be extraordinarily helpful. And of course, internal rejections and external rejections, you can play with those a lot. So I would encourage you to, whatever it is you're thinking of doing, do it because it's probably going to work.
All right. So this is from Larry. Where can I learn more about the cognitive science you're using?
Well, there's this brand new search engine, and it's called Google. And so what I do is I would put in cognitive science in that Google search box, and then off you go. But I mean, it's kind of like, can you teach me everything that you've learned in the last 7 minutes with about three sentences of, I can't. But what I can say is that there's a guy named John Vervaeke, who's University of Toronto. He has a series on YouTube, which I highly recommend, called Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. It's 50 hours and it's fantastic. And it will walk you through the present sort of thinking about cognitive science, and it cites all the big players like Kant and Heidegger and Paul Tillich and blah, blah, blah. There's thousands of, the thing about cognitive science is that it's a synthesis of neuroscience, of psychology, of archaeology, of sociology. It's not like this super rigid, it's not like molecular biology where it's just like Krebs cycle, Krebs cycle, Krebs cycle. It's more, you know, fluid. So definitely start with Vervaeke and take it from there.
All right. I think we got through all the questions I saw. If I miss one, somebody, you can drop it into the chat real quick. We had a question about StoryGrid Live. So as of now, we are canceling/postponing the StoryGrid Live in September, just for all related to COVID, but all kinds of reasons around that. So we don't know if we'll push it back to the spring or just push it all the way back to 2021. If you were one of the ones that purchased the guild membership at the 2019 StoryGrid Live, and you get a free ticket to the next, what's supposed to be 2020, you know, that will still be good whenever we hold it at the next point. So, hold on, a couple have come in. Yeah, Alyssa, I just asked the question about the obligatory scenes. Follow-up question, is the opening of one's goal state / reality happening in the middle build two or in the ending payoff?
Well, I think the explosion happens at the end of middle build two, but the actual procedural movements through the new open framing happen in the ending payoff. So it's sort of like at the end of middle build two in the Silence of the Lambs, Clarice Starling is in the laundry room. You know, she's been sent back to the academy. She's told she's not to leave the academy. She's been fired. Get out of here. You're a pain in the ass. And that's when her framing opens. And she has that moment where like, shit, I'm gonna die someday. There's somebody who's dying right now. I might be able to save them. Therefore, perhaps I should not give a shit about the FBI Academy anymore and do what I can to save another human being's life. So we see that in the film with, you know, incredible actress. Jodie Foster, you just see it in her eyes. Ah, shit, I guess I gotta go to Belvedere, Ohio. And then bang, then we're into the ending payoff. She goes to see Jack Crawford. He gives her the money. Crawford's wife is dead. Remember, death is usually somewhere around the end, middle build too. Something's dying. Because in order to move and break frame, it requires loss. So So when I got married, it required me to come to the realization that maybe spending all of my time playing golf and watching football wasn't really going to work for me any longer. So I had to lose that. It died, right? And that's a good way of thinking about the end of mental build too. It's loss. Something's got to die in order for something else to replace it. And that something else is a better attunement to the natural world. So Clarice Starling locks in to reality in that ending payoff. She's the only one who sees what's true. All these other idiots are flying around and, you know, Buffalo Bill's getting away with it, except her. She has now attuned herself to reality. And off she goes. She builds a new skill. And it's one of the most thrilling moments in fiction.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. And we can go ahead and start the sprint now. And I'll let Allison take over. Yeah,
thanks, Sean.
So we will
much,
see
Sean.
You on Monday.
Thank you. Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Have a great day.
You too.